The Federal News Update for Sunday, January 4th, 2026. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
We are, and I don't think this is an exaggeration, staring down an absolute deluge of primary source material. We have White House memos, classified DOD briefings, even court filings from the Southern District of New York.
All generated in the last 48 hours.
Exactly. And it's not just the volume of it, is it? It's how it all connects.
That's the real challenge here. This isn't just a collection of events. What we're doing in this deep dive is unique because we're looking at a pivotal, definitive inflection point.
An inflection point.
Mm-hmm. A moment where U.S. foreign policy, I mean, we're talking about unilateral kinetic action against a sovereign nation, collided head-on with this profound, synchronized administrative restructuring right here at home.
And that is precisely our mission today. We have to provide an exhaustive, unabridged archival record of what the U.S. federal government was doing on January 3rd and 4th, 2026.
And that means digging into every data point, every number.
Every piece of technical language they used.
Yeah.
Because you have to understand both sides of this coin, from the capture of a head of state all the way down to how we pay a Border Patrol agent.
So we should probably start where the immediate global shockwave originated.
South America.
The military action. Codenamed Operation Absolute Resolve.
Okay, let's unpack this. The documents are very clear. This was a unilateral kinetic military intervention in the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the primary explicit strategic result the administration is claiming from this?
The stated goal, and you can see this in the first wave of press releases, was the swift decapitation of the Venezuelan executive leadership.
Decapitation. Strong word.
It is. And the documents confirm the mission succeeded with the capture of Nicolas Maduro Moros and Juarez.
And his wife, Celia Flores.
And Celia Flores, yes. No. But it goes further. The operation also claims to have executed a rapid degradation of key command and control nodes within the regime's military.
So cripple their ability to fight back immediately.
Essentially, yes. To prevent a cohesive, organized counter-response.
But this wasn't something that just happened overnight. I mean, the archival record lays out a very detailed operational preamble, a multi-month campaign to what shaped the environment.
To shape the battlefield, exactly. Before a single bomb dropped on Caracas, you have to look at the shaping activities. This is where the framing becomes absolutely critical.
How so?
For months leading up to January 3rd, the U.S. had maintained an intensified naval presence in the Caribbean. Now, publicly, this was all about counter-narcotics.
But the real objective was different.
The clear strategic objective was to isolate the regime, to stress its defense perimeter. And we have a specific data point on the scale of this. The U.S. conducted over 35 specific strikes against vessels alleged to be trafficking narcotics.
35? That's not just a patrol.
No.
Over a period of months.
Yeah.
That is a sustained low-level military campaign. It's just operating under the cover of law enforcement.
And it created a de facto isolation of Caracas long before the main event. And to back that up, to really project power, the USS Gerald R. Ford Aircraft Carrier Group was deployed to the region.
When was that?
Back in November of 2025. The documentation is explicit about its purpose. Provide robust air and sea support to enforce that de facto blockade. They wanted to ensure Caracas was cut off from any potential external help from allies like Russia or Iran.
Okay, so the stage is set. Let's move to the kinetic execution itself. It was highly synchronized, broken down into three phases, starting in the very early morning hours of January 3rd. We should use Venezuelan Eastern Time, VET, for this.
That makes sense.
Walk us through phase one, electronic and cyber suppression.
Right. Phase one, this was the critical enabling phase, happening between 01.00 and 02.00 VET. The very first public signal that something was happening came from the FAA.
The FAA.
The Federal Aviation Administration. They issued a notice to airmen, a NOTAM, at 06.000 UTC.
Which, for our listeners, that's about 1.00 a.m. in Venezuela.
Exactly. And this NOTAM effectively closed all of Venezuelan airspace to U.S. traffic. It was the first move. It sealed the operational box and established air dominance before a single kinetic strike occurred.
And at the very same time as that NOTAM, the lights went out in the capital.
A catastrophic failure of the power grid in Caracas. And the administration was quick to claim this was a deliberate action, not just, you know, collateral damage.
Right. I saw the quote from President Trump.
Yes. He later confirmed it was a calculated effect, stating explicitly, and I'm quoting, that the lights were largely turned off due to an expertise that we have.
An expertise that we have. So what does our analysis suggest that means?
Well, when you combine that language with the battle damage assessments that Cal later, it strongly suggests the use of advanced cyberkinetic payloads, or possibly graphite weaponry.
Wait, cyberkinetic? That sounds like something out of science fiction. Explain that in practical terms. Why use that instead of a conventional bomb?
It's a very specialized, non-lethal way to attack infrastructure. Graphite weaponry, for instance, involves spraying clouds of extremely fine carbon fibers. It's basically conductive dust over electrical substations.
And that causes what? A massive short circuit?
An immediate massive short circuit. The entire system fails instantly. The key tactical advantage here is that you get instant darkness and confusion, which is perfect cover for infiltration teams, but you do it without permanently destroying the physical infrastructure.
So it's a temporary weapon. You're disabling the grid, not destroying it.
Precisely.
Which preserves the generation capacity for later use under the U.S. plan for direct stewardship. That's a fascinating layer of operational control.
It maximizes tactical surprise while minimizing the long-term cost of reconstruction. It aligns perfectly with the immediate economic objectives of the whole intervention.
Okay, let's move into phase two, strategic air interdiction. This is from Aero 2.00 to 03.00 VET. We know high-yield explosions were reported. We need the tactical granularity here. What were the specific targets and what was the purpose behind hitting each one?
We have three primary specified target sets from the initial reports. First and most critical was Fort Tiuna.
Fort Tiuna, that's the main military complex in Caracas, right? Headquarters of their Ministry of Defense.
It is. The goal here was straightforward. Decapitate the chain of command. You hit the most senior military leadership where they live and work, preventing them from issuing coordinated orders to the Bolivarian National Guard or any other loyalist forces.
Take out the brain before the body can react. And the second target.
La Carlota Air Base. It's strategically located right near the heart of the city. Hitting La Carlota had a dual purpose. First, ground any Venezuelan air assets that might try to challenge U.S. air superiority.
And second.
And this is crucial for what comes next. You clear the runways and the approaches for U.S. rotary wing operations, helicopters,
yep,
which were absolutely essential for the extraction phase.
Clear the air and clear the path. Got it. What about the third target? The documentation mentions the coastal sector of Catia La Mar.
Yes, Catia La Mar is critical because of its proximity to Simón Bolívar International Airport. The strikes there were aimed at military installations that were guarding that coastal approach. It was about ensuring the air-sea corridor stayed secure for the rapid exfiltration of the high-value targets.
Which brings us directly to phase three, the HVT extraction. This is between 03.00 and 04.00 VET. So in the midst of the darkness and the airstrikes, who were the specific actors on the ground tasked with securing Maduro and Flores?
The reports identify the absolute most elite U.S. Army assets. You're talking about elements of Delta Force, officially known as the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta.
And they wouldn't go in alone.
No. They were supported by the elite aviation unit known as the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment.
The Night Stalkers.
The Night Stalkers. They specialize in that low-level, high-speed, nighttime infiltration and exfiltration. They're the best in the world at it.
A mission like this, I mean, the risk is immense. What did the reports say about resistance on the ground?
General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he confirmed that U.S. helicopters did come under fire during the extraction. We know at least one airframe was struck.
But it was still able to fly.
He emphasized that it remained airworthy, yes. And crucially, General Kane confirmed no U.S. fatalities.
Zero U.S. fatalities. In a kinetic decapitation strike against the leadership of a nation with a standing army, that is a detail that will be highlighted in every single after-action report.
It will be. He did, however, report that a few injuries were sustained among the assault force.
Okay, so the HVTs are secured. Where were they taken?
They were exfiltrated by helicopter directly to the primary amphibious assault ship waiting off the coast, the USS Iwo Jima, LHD-7, or a similar vessel in that group. From there, an immediate transfer to a fixed-wing aircraft for transport directly to the U.S.
And where did they land?
They landed at Stewart Air National Guard Base in New York, where they were immediately taken into the custody of the Department of Justice for processing.
Now we have to turn to the consequences on the ground. The battle damage assessment, the BDA, and the civilian toll. It's grim.
It is. Initial reports estimate at least 40 confirmed Venezuelan fatalities. These were primarily regime military personnel caught in those strikes on Fort Tuna and other command sites. And the structural damage, especially at Fort Tuna, was reported as severe. Large plumes of smoke were visible over the city for hours.
And we have to address this specific collateral damage in Cachalamar. This detail immediately compromises the administration's narrative of a purely surgical operation.
Absolutely. It's a critical point. Specific intelligence confirms that an airstrike, which was likely intended for those nearby coastal defense areas, impacted a three-story civilian apartment complex.
And this resulted in a civilian death?
Yes. The death of an 80-year-old woman named Rosa Gonzalez. This specific named civilian casualty is already becoming a central point for international condemnation. It ensures that the intervention's legitimacy is challenged immediately outside of the U.S. political sphere.
That civilian toll sets a grim background for what the administration is claiming is, of all things, a law enforcement action. So let's pivot now. Let's examine the legal documents they're using to justify deploying Delta Force and high-yield munitions. The administration is insisting this was not an act of war. It was a counter-narcotics arrest. What is the precise legal predicate that authorized this?
The entire justification, everything the administration is leaning on, it rests on the unsealed superseding indictment filed in the Southern District of New York, the STNY.
And Attorney General Pam Bondi was the one who laid this out.
She was. She explicitly framed the entire military operation as, and this is the term they're using, a high-risk counter-narcotics arrest. They are asserting the executive branch's power to enforce DOJ warrants anywhere on the globe.
So let's get into the details of the charges, because this is the foundation for this whole unprecedented legal structure.
Okay. The core of the case is a charge of narco-terrorism conspiracy. The indictment meticulously alleges that Maduro and Flores led a massive drug trafficking organization known as the Cartel de los Soles, or the Cartel of the Suns.
And for how long?
For a surprisingly long time. The indictment specifies from 1999 to 2020. It claims they systematically used the entire Venezuelan state apparatus to facilitate these colossal movements of cocaine, all aimed at the U.S. market.
And the terrorism part of narco-terrorism, where does that come from?
That links back to an alleged conspiracy with the Colombian terrorist group, the FARC, the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia. The indictment explicitly states the goal of this joint conspiracy was to, quote, flood the United States with cocaine.
Flood the U.S. with cocaine.
Yes, and the administration then layered on a very particular interpretation of that. They characterized this flow of drugs not just as a crime, but as a form of asymmetric warfare directed against the United States itself.
And there were weapons charges, too.
Severe weapons offenses, yes. Specifically, possession and use of machine guns and destructive devices in furtherance of these criminal enterprises.
So let me see if I have this right. The legal argument is, a foreign leader committed a crime, that crime amounts to an act of asymmetric warfare against the U.S., therefore a DOJ warrant is sufficient authorization for a full-scale kinetic military invasion and arrest.
That is the profound constitutional conflict at the heart of this.
And it completely bypasses the legislative branch.
Completely. By labeling it a law enforcement action, the administration is attempting to sidestep the War Powers Resolution and the need for a congressional authorization for the use of force in AUMF. Constitutional scholars are already locked in a furious debate over whether this redefinition, a criminal indictment replacing a declaration of war, represents a fundamental, permanent shift in executive war powers.
Okay, so assuming for a moment that the administration prevails in that legal debate threat, let's look at the plan for the aftermath. The post-intervention governance strategy. President Trump has labeled it direct stewardship. How radical is this declaration compared to historical U.S. intervention models?
It is arguably the most radical declaration we've seen since the early 20th century. The president explicitly stated, in no uncertain terms, that the U.S. would, quote, run the country during an indefinite transitional period.
Run the country.
Yes. This means rejecting the entire post-Cold War light footprint model of merely supporting a local proxy or installing an interim government run by a national opposition figure. This signals an intention to install a direct U.S.-led military or civil administration to stabilize and restructure the entire nation.
What about the Venezuelan opposition figures, people the U.S. has supported for years, like Juan Guaido or Maria Corina Machado?
They've been effectively dismissed. The president stated very clearly that Maria Corina Machado does not have the support necessary to consolidate power or govern effectively in this kind of unstable climate.
So years of diplomatic effort spent building up that opposition is just gone.
It signals that the U.S. will prioritize stability and its own economic goals over a democratic transition led by local figures.
Which brings us to the central economic engine of this direct stewardship doctrine.
It is the immediate aggressive rehabilitation of the Venezuelan oil sector by U.S. firms. That is the pillar of the entire strategy. The administration sees that oil wealth, not just as a resource for Venezuela, but as a mechanism to stabilize global energy prices and generate massive revenue for the U.S.
There's a quote from the president on this, too, wasn't there?
A very unambiguous one. He said, "We're going to have our very large United States oil companies go in, spend billions of dollars, fix the badly broken infrastructure, and start making money."
The goal is twofold, then. Flood the market with oil and
rapidly generate revenue to recoup the costs of the intervention. It's an economic play as much as a military one.
Of course, an action like this has immediate geopolitical fallout. The global reaction was swift and, for the most part, furious. Let's start with the major strategic rivals. Russia.
Russia reacted immediately. They are a principal creditor and a military partner to Caracas. They denounced the strike as an unacceptable violation of sovereignty and a grave threat to international stability. For them, losing Venezuela as a client state is a major strategic degradation of their influence in the Western Hemisphere.
And China. They're heavily invested in Venezuela's oil through massive loan agreements.
The People's Republic of China holds billions in Venezuelan debt, all secured against future oil shipments. Beijing demanded the immediate release of Maduro and urged the U.S. to stop toppling governments.
They used the phrase hegemonic behavior, I believe.
They did, characterizing it as classic hegemonic behavior that violates the UN Charter. They're deeply concerned about the precedent this sets for the safety of their massive global investment.
And Iran, which has used Venezuela as a logistical and political hub in Latin America for years.
Tehran immediately called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. They view this decapitation strike as a dangerous, successful precedent that could, you know, very easily be applied to their own leadership. You can be sure their internal security alert levels are significantly elevated.
Let's look closer to home, in the immediate region. The schism is palpable. Brazil's reaction is critical here.
Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, issued the most forceful condemnation from any major regional leader. He described the operation as a flagrant violation of international law, and he compared it to the darkest moments of 20th century U.S. hegemony in the region.
That's going to cause a significant diplomatic freeze between Washington and Brasilia.
An outright freeze, most likely.
Meanwhile, right on Venezuela's border, Colombia is mobilizing troops.
They are. While President Gustavo Petro condemned the U.S. aggression on principle, his practical response was strictly defensive. He's moving the Colombian armed forces to the border region. It's a strategic move. He's anticipating a massive spillover of refugees fleeing the power vacuum and potentially volatile FARC dissidents crossing the border to escape U.S. military attention. It's about containment.
But not everyone in the region was opposed. One key ally gave their full support.
That was Argentina. President Javier Milei celebrated the operation, aligning fully with the U.S. position. He framed the capture as a clear victory for freedom and a blow against socialism. Argentina is now the lone, critical, supportive voice for the U.S. in South America.
And the European Union. They'd already said Maduro lacked legitimacy.
The EU maintained a very cautious distance. Officials like High Representative Kaja Kallas, they reiterated that Maduro lacks legitimacy, but they stopped well short of endorsing the military extraction.
They called for restraint.
Restraint and strict respect for international law. They are fundamentally concerned about the precedent of a unilateral invasion based on a domestic criminal indictment. It's the legal framework that worries them.
But the U.S. did get unequivocal backing from one other key geopolitical ally.
Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu offered full-throated support, praising the president's bold leadership. This aligns perfectly with Israel's long-standing strategic interest in countering Iran's influence in South America, an influence that operated freely under the Maduro regime.
This intense global friction leads us right back to Capitol Hill and the domestic separation of powers dispute. Let's move there. The congressional conflict and what's being called an oversight failure. The administration cited operational security, OPSEC, for not notifying Congress. What exactly was the breach of protocol?
The breach concerned the most sensitive legislative body for these matters, the Gang of Eight.
And for our listeners, that's the top leadership of both parties in both the House and the Senate, plus the Intelligence Committee leadership.
Exactly. Standard protocol for a kinetic action of the scale requires notifying that group before the operation begins. The documentation confirms, unequivocally, that the Gang of Eight was not briefed.
That is an extraordinary breach of statutory notification requirements. Mm-hmm. When were they finally told?
The notifications from the DOD and the White House were only transmitted after the operation was already underway.
So they presented Congress with a fait accompli.
Precisely. The administration's official justification was the specific fear of leaks from Congress. They argued that OPSE requirements superseded the statutory notification requirements because of the extreme sensitivity of targeting a sitting head of state.
And this immediately triggered intense partisan polarization. How did the Republican leadership respond to being sidelined like that?
They largely rallied around the outcome, not the process. Speaker Mike Johnson praised the operation as decisive and justified, focusing entirely on the narrative of holding a narco-terrorist accountable.
And the Senate Majority Leader.
John Thune framed it as the execution of a DOJ warrant. Again, that deliberate legal framing. He called it an important first step in law enforcement, not an act of war.
The Secretary of State designate Marco Rubio also defended it.
Yes, Senator Marco Rubio publicly reinforced the president's claims, arguing that for sensitive, time-critical special operations, overriding congressional discretion was a necessity.
So on the Democratic side, the opposition was immediate, and it was centered strictly on the Constitution.
Exactly. Representative James McGovern immediately labeled the strike illegal and unjustified, pointing to the explicit lack of a congressional authorization for the use of force.
And we're already seeing moves to force a debate on this.
We are. Senator Tim Kaine and Representative Joaquin Castro are already working to introduce war powers resolution privileged resolutions. These are legislative tools designed to force a debate and a vote on the military action. It effectively sets a 60-day clock on military engagement unless Congress authorizes it.
So the debate has already shifted. It's not about the success of the mission anymore. It's about the legality of the process used to launch it.
That's the lasting legacy of this moment. It's all about defining the legal limits of executive authority in conflict.
Okay, let's execute a major pivot here. Because while the world's attention was fixed on the kinetic action in Caracas, the administrative state back home was undergoing a simultaneous and profound restructuring, almost a quiet coup of the bureaucracy.
Mm.
We're now digging into the domestic realignment, workforce, fiscal, and security hardening. It starts with the fiscal year 2026 pay adjustments.
This is a classic example of synchronized domestic policy.
Mm-hmm.
The administration finalized the 2026 pay tables, and when you look at them, they reveal a very deliberate strategy. They're creating a bifurcated federal workforce.
Bifurcated how?
Financially prioritizing security and enforcement personnel over the general civil service.
So let's look at the general schedule, the GS adjustment first.
Mm-hmm.
What was the base pay increase for the average federal worker, and what was the crucial caveat that makes it an effective pay cut?
The general civilian workforce, this is pursuant to Executive Order 1.368, received a meager 1.0% across-the-board increase to their base pay.
1%.
1%. And this was effective the first pay period of January. But the real sting, the defining financial detail, is the locality pay.
It was frozen.
Completely frozen. The order explicitly dictates that locality pay percentages are frozen at 2025 levels, no matter what the cost of living increases are in places like D.C., New York, or San Francisco.
So given inflation, a 1% base increase with frozen locality pay is, in reality, a pay cut.
It's a de facto reduction in purchasing power for the vast majority of federal employees. They are, in effect, financially subsidizing other budget priorities.
Now, compare that effective 1% rate to what they're calling the law enforcement carve-out.
Yeah.
This is where that security prioritization becomes just overtly clear.
It's a stark deviation, and it's made possible by special authorities. The Office of Personnel Management, OPM, was directed to use special pay authorities under 5 U.S.C. 5305 to grant an additional 2.8% increase.
But only for federal law enforcement officers.
EOs.
Exclusively for them, bringing their total adjustment up to roughly 3.8%, which is designed to match the military pay raise. The strategic intent seems crystal clear.
It's to bolster recruitment and retention for key law and order agencies. You're talking about the frontline agencies, Customs and Border Protection, the Bureau of Prisons. And OPM didn't just give a blanket directive. They implemented this through specific, highly detailed special rate schedules.
The documents mention schedules L001 through L133. That sounds like bureaucratic micromanagement to the extreme. What's the significance of that?
It means they didn't just give a flat percentage boost across the board. OPM meticulously created 133 distinct custom pay scales. They're tailored to specific geographic regions and different LEO roles to maximize the recruitment incentive in the most critical high attrition areas like the southern border. It is highly surgical.
A clear signal, then. The general administrative bureaucracy is being financially squeezed while the security apparatus is being prioritized and rewarded. This ties directly into the administration's other big objective, the return-to-office mandate.
This is the OPM guidance designed to effectively terminate the widespread federal telework era. The new directive is explicit. It states that remote work cannot be used to avoid working full-time in person from an agency worksite or to shorten the workday.
So it's about physical presence, bums in seats.
Full physical presence during core hours. It eliminates the flexibility that had become common with telework.
And this RTO mandate aligns perfectly with the consolidation goals of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. What is the expected or maybe the intended impact of this on workforce morale?
The RTO policy, especially when you compound it with the effective pay cut, it's fundamentally functioning as a soft reduction in force, a soft RIF.
A soft RIF, meaning people will just quit.
Exactly. We already saw historic attrition numbers in 2025. 317,000 federal workers left their jobs. This new policy is expected to accelerate that trend significantly in the first quarter of 2026, as employees who are unwilling or unable to comply with the mandate just choose to separate voluntarily.
And I assume we should expect a legal fight immediately.
Without a doubt. We expect immediate aggressive litigation from the major federal employee unions, like the NTEU and AFGE. They'll challenge these mandates as violations of existing collective bargaining agreements. This could lead to injunctions and significant operational disruptions in civilian agencies like Treasury and Commerce.
And amidst all this, with rising climate crises and a potentially severe storm season on the horizon, we also have a major strategic reduction at FEMA. Some insiders are calling it the New Year's Eve massacre.
The timing is critical and seems very deliberate. Just as the year turned, FEMA executed significant personnel cuts. They issued termination notices to staff within the cadre of On-Call Response and Recovery, or CORE.
And the CORE employees are the backbone of disaster response.
They are the essential operational backbone for deployment, mitigation, and recovery. They're the ones who go into the disaster zones.
When were these notices made effective?
Effective January 2, 2026. Shrinking this critical operational footprint right before the start of the hurricane and wildfire seasons raises severe concerns about the agency's readiness to respond to the next major disaster.
Okay, let's move into the granular regulatory shifts. This is where we see the administrative state churning away beneath the surface of the big headlines, using the regulatory power of the cabinet departments. Let's start with Treasury, specifically the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC.
Treasury executed highly targeted financial warfare operations on December 31st and January 1st. And what you see here isn't just punishment, it's strategic synchronization with the military strike.
How so?
OFAC sanctioned four companies and blocked four vessels.
Was a specific vessel named?
Yes. The documentation specifically calls out the Nord Star. These entities were all identified as being part of the so-called Shadow Fleet, the network's moving Venezuelan oil in violation of existing U.S. sanctions.
Why that precise timing, hitting them immediately before the kinetic intervention?
By designating these entities just prior to the decapitation strike, Treasury achieved two critical goals. First, it immediately cut off illicit revenue streams that were available to Maduro loyalists. This weakens their ability to fund a counterinsurgency.
And second?
Second, and this is crucial for the direct stewardship model, it clears the logistical pathways. It ensures that when U.S. companies move in, they won't face immediate legal or contractual challenges from these previously sanctioned shadow fleet operators. It's a cleanup operation before the main corporate installation begins.
Okay, from Treasury to the Department of the Interior, DOI, we have a highly specific land transfer for border security.
This is a classic example of executive action overriding previous land management mandates. DOI transferred jurisdiction of 760 acres of public land in San Diego and Imperial Counties, California.
And transferred it to whom?
To the Department of the Navy. But it's the new designation that matters. This action creates a national defense area.
And that classification allows them to do what?
It overrides typical environmental and public land use regulations. It facilitates the rapid construction of permanent military projects focused specifically on southern border security, potentially bypassing years of regulatory review.
We also saw a very visible, almost symbolic change from the National Park Service.
Yes, a small but potent piece of political branding. As of January 1st, the NPS implemented a new fee structure. But the detail is that the physical America the Beautiful passes, the ones that grant you access to all national parks, now prominently feature an image of President Trump.
Let's turn to energy and environment, the EPA and the DOE, two actions here that seem to provide significant regulatory relief to the fossil fuel industry.
Starting with the EPA and coal ash, the agency proposed extending the deadline for unlined coal ash pond closures.
Extending it from when to when?
From 2028 all the way out to October 17th, 2031.
That's 3 extra years. What's the impact of that?
It grants coal-fired power plants 3 additional years of operational regulatory relief. It allows them to operate without incurring the often prohibitive costs of closing and remediating these environmentally sensitive ash ponds. It directly supports the administration's stated goal of maximizing domestic fossil fuel production.
And the Department of Energy took an even more direct step regarding a specific power plant in Colorado.
This was the emergency coal order. The DOE invoked its emergency authorities under the Federal Power Act. They forced the Craig Generating Station, Unit 1, to remain operational through March 2026.
And that plant was scheduled to be retired.
It was. This action legally overrides its scheduled retirement date.
But is that even economically sustainable for the operator?
Well, the operator, Tri-State Generation, publicly warned that forcing emergency maintenance on a unit that was already being decommissioned would inevitably lead to inefficient operation and critically increase consumer costs for the people served by that grid.
So an ideological push overriding market consideration.
That's exactly what it looks like.
Now for the Department of Education, ED. The strategy here appears to be one of structural dismantling, using specific bureaucratic mechanisms.
Yes. The administration is actively using executive tools to decentralize the department, effectively trying to hollow out its authority without needing a difficult legislative fight to abolish it. They announced 6 new comprehensive interagency agreements, or IAAs. This is their unbundling strategy in action.
Can you give us specifics on those functional transfers?
Sure. Core functions are being permanently shifted out of ED. For instance, all the workforce development programs, which are massive budget items, are being moved to the Department of Labor.
And what about the Bureau of Indian Education?
That's a critical one. The administration is moving the Bureau of Indian Education Schools, a highly sensitive and specialized function, over to the Department of the Interior. This transfers budget authority, personnel, and accountability away from ED, functionally shrinking its domain through bureaucratic fiat.
There was also a new national security measure regarding foreign funding for universities.
Yes. A new reporting portal was launched on January 2nd. It requires universities to disclose all foreign gifts and contracts above a certain threshold. The administration is framing this as a critical national security measure, specifically to track and mitigate foreign influence, especially from rivals like China.
Finally, let's look at the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, and Immigration Controls. This is immediately relevant to the instability in Venezuela.
DHS issued Proclamation 1998, effective January 1st. This action suspends entry for nationals of 19 countries. That list specifically includes Venezuela, Haiti, and Afghanistan.
And the justification?
The stated justification is national security concerns linked to high visa overstay rates and what they call unreliable civil documents from these nations.
Now, this creates a profound policy contradiction. Given the kinetic action is taken to Venezuela, what is the critical vulnerability this creates for Venezuelans trying to flee the instability?
This creates what you could call a temporary protected status protection gap. That's a huge problem. While TPS for Venezuela was technically extended to October 2026, it applies only to those who were already present in the U.S. before a very specific and now outdated date, July 31st, 2023.
So anyone fleeing the current conflict?
Anyone fleeing the violence and chaos resulting from Operation Absolute Resolve is barred from TPS protection. And at the same time, they are subject to the immediate entry suspensions from this new proclamation.
That is a profound irony. The policy effectively bars legal entry and protection to the very people fleeing the instability that the U.S. kinetic action helped create.
It creates a massive, vulnerable cohort of refugees with no legal pathway to safety, which directly contradicts any of the stated humanitarian goals of the intervention.
Okay, let's move to our final section, strategic assessment and forward outlook. Based on this exhaustive archival record, what are the immediate risks in the next 24 to 96 hours?
The primary immediate risk is the power vacuum in Venezuela. With the central chain of command gone, we expect chaotic, localized violence from two highly dangerous non-state actors. The armed paramilitary groups known as colectivos, who were loyal to Maduro, and also the remnants of FARC dissidents who operated freely in the country.
And they would likely target U.S. assets.
U.S. assets, regional interests. They'll use asymmetric, terrorist-like tactics.
And regionally, Colombia's mobilization signals they are preparing for the worst-case scenario.
Absolutely. The mobilization of Colombian troops, that signals their anticipation of either a mass refugee exodus, a humanitarian crisis on an immense scale, or cross-border violence from these displaced armed groups. The U.S. direct stewardship model has to rapidly establish security and basic humanitarian corridors to prevent a catastrophe.
On the economic front, the energy market implications are really central to the entire strategic success of this operation.
The success or failure of this hinges entirely on the rapid re-entry and rehabilitation capabilities of U.S. oil majors. If they can get the PDVSA infrastructure up and running quickly, the potential exists to flood the global market with Venezuelan heavy crude.
Which would lower global prices.
Immediately. And that would achieve a major geopolitical objective, placing severe economic pressure on strategic rivals like Russia and Iran, whose budgets rely heavily on high oil prices.
But the risk to that plan is high, isn't it? The risk of instability on the ground.
Extremely high. The risk of pipeline sabotage by regime loyalists, the colectivos, or even local opposition elements who resent a U.S. takeover, that remains the single greatest operational and economic threat to the direct stewardship model. Any major pipeline failure could cripple the operation's financial timeline.
And domestically, we mentioned the potential for labor unrest. What's the forward outlook on that?
The synchronized policy of the effective pay cut and the strict return-to-office mandate is predicted to trigger immediate high-profile litigation from the federal unions, NTU, and AFGE. We expect them to request injunctions based on violations of collective bargaining agreements, which could lead to operational gridlock or significant labor slowdowns in civilian agencies.
Finally, the global strategic assessment. What does this unilateral action mean for America's relationship with emerging power blocs, specifically BRICS?
The aggressive unilateral nature of this action in Venezuela will almost certainly accelerate the security and economic integration of the BRICS bloc, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
Right.
Because these nations will view the Venezuela strike as definitive, undeniable proof that the U.S. financial system and its military power represent an existential threat to their national sovereignty. This shared perception is expected to rapidly speed up their existing de-dollarization efforts and solidify the formation of more robust mutual defense and economic pacts. Pacts designed specifically to bypass the U.S.-led global order.
So to synthesize this entire deep dive, the last 48 hours present a dual synchronized narrative of immense consequence. On the foreign policy front, you have the highly kinetic, successful decapitation of the Maduro regime, all legally framed as a counter-narcotics law enforcement action based on a DOJ indictment.
While at the exact same time, domestically, you have this rigorous restructuring effort.
A soft RA via the RTO mandate, significant cuts at FEMA right before storm season, and a clear financial prioritization of law enforcement with a 3.8% raise over the general workforce's effective pay freeze.
It is the ultimate expression of executive control, militarily abroad and administratively at home, all executed within a single two-day period.
And so here's the final provocative thought for you to consider as you process this sheer volume of information. The administration successfully defined major military action involving advanced weaponry, commandos, and the capture of a head of state as a law enforcement arrest authorized by a Department of Justice indictment, thereby attempting to bypass Congress. If this legal predicate, based on the charge of asymmetric warfare through drug trafficking, is allowed to replace the requirement for a congressional AUMF, what are the long-term implications for the definition and the scope of a U.S. president's war powers? I would encourage you to look deeper into that concept of asymmetric warfare cited in the indictment, as that phrase seems to be the linchpin for legitimizing this entire new doctrine of executive military action.
That is a fascinating and, frankly, a profoundly dangerous question for the future of democratic checks and balances, especially in a world where global conflict can be redefined by a criminal statute.
Thank you for joining us for this archival deep dive into the actions of January 3rd and 4th, 2026.